Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hey, welcome back to Passcast, everybody. This week we're talking about Pininfarina, a company you might know a little about. You've at least heard their name. You've seen their name on countless Ferraris and other awesome cars throughout history. But how did they come to be? Well, we're going to find out right now. It's Passcast. Let's hit that intro. The year is 1968, and the lights of the Turin Motor Show are ablaze. Camera flashes pop and blind, and hushed whispers fill the air. On the Pininfarina stage, a shape emerges from beneath a silken shroud and reveals a vision so radical that the convention quiets down to listen. The car is the Ferrari P6, a mid-engine prototype that seems impossibly low and features a severely pointed nose and three sets of unblinking headlight eyes that stare down from each side. The bodywork is an absolute masterclass in clean, integrated design. It flows effortlessly towards an inverted tail that sports seven wraparound slats reminiscent of louvers, except these are much more functional. This isn't just a concept car. It's Pininfarina, alongside Ferrari, defining what would later be named the supercar. And it all started with a stripped Dino 206S chassis. The unveiling at Turin was a blend of audacious design and technological prophecy, and it solidified Pininfarina's reputation as not just a coach builder, but a visionary architect of automotive dreams. The unveiling of such a radical prototype at a major motor show immediately established Pininfarina as a company that set trends instead of following them through exploiting tradition and defining innovation. So, how did they get their start designing car bodies for some of the most important European automakers of all time? Where does the name Pininfarina come from? And what are they up to now? This week on Pass Gas, it's Carrozzeria Pininfarina. Did I get that right?
I don't know. I don't speak Italian.
He just looks Italian.
I look British.
Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. I'm going to stop touching the mic for the sake of our audio man, Mark's ears. Welcome back to the show. This week, we're talking Pininfarina, a name you have probably heard of. Across from me is Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And Joe Weber.
What's up, Wink Wink Nation? We're back.
Dad squared. Is this your first time back on the podcast since?
After 6 weeks.
Wow. How's it going?
Pretty good. I'm a little bit tired.
A little bit? Is it better than last time?
Yeah. A million times better. This kid is way more chill than why it was when he was a baby.
Another boy.
We got Emily wanted a girl, and she got two boys. So here we are.
It's
been good. Cool. We've had a lot of support, which is great. And
well, you in 15 months you can have a girl.
Yes. Yeah. That's another thing. Is they're only 15 months apart, so they're going to be either best buds or like rivals.
Yeah, they look like best buds already, though.
Yeah, they're hugging each other.
Are you going to try to get them into sports and stuff?
I'm not going to be overwhelming about it, but yeah, I give Wyatt a basketball and he bounces it, and I try to get him to throw a baseball to me already.
My cousins are pretty close in age. Like, I have one cousin who's a month older than me, and 15 months ish, but very close to that. And they're cool now, but they were like bitter rivals.
Wow.
Oh, like the entire time.
I mean, they're cool. Like they used to be nerds.
No.
Beat them up.
No, they're always cool. But like now they're cool with each other.
Yeah.
Because growing up, they were like intense sports rivals. Because like my older cousin, Ian, was like a freak athlete. And Connor's like also a good athlete. But like Ian was. Yeah. So
there's no Ian.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Me and Emily joke that we want...
So that is a possibility. My point being, they could be bitter rivals, Joe.
Me and Emily joke that if we have two boys and neither one of them becomes an NFL kicker, then we've failed.
Mm.
Because I feel like... Look at Adam Vinatieri's career. You know, he played until he was 42.
Whoa.
He is like one of the highest scoring people in the NFL ever.
Because
he doesn't have CTE.
Because he scored so many extra points that makes him like a higher scorer.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, cool.
So I'd love if he was an NFL kicker. I feel like now the this is getting too deep into the weeds, but I feel like 60-yard field goals are the norm now, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah, I agree. To where it's like, oh, they're in field goal range. You're like, they're at the 50.
Yeah. So it's a high bar. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be like a sports dad, but I'm going to support anything that he wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, what wasn't the field goal range or like the field goal record just set recently? Like,
yeah, it was like 68 yards or 72 yards or something. That's crazy insane. Like that.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. Which is over 200 feet. Yeah. That's crazy to think about. Like kicking a ball that's not supposed to fly like that over 200 feet and being accurate with it.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And I'll tell you what, a big push for that, like Bill Belichick really drilled down on that. And he also developed a lot of good coaches.
Yeah.
You know who else is a great coach builder? Pininfarina.
Oh, damn. That's so good.
Damn.
That was masterful. Yeah, I want to circle back to the intro because the car that they're describing is the car that we were trying to figure out.
Yeah.
On the concourse, when we were at the House of Lamborghini, and we were having drinks, and we were trying to figure out what car they were unloading.
And after looking into it, wasn't it like a resto mod too?
It was,
it a legit?
You guys saw this?
It was the one. Yes.
Wow.
We were like, what is that? It looks like a Corvette, but it's obviously not a Corvette. The dimensions were different. And I was the one who was like, I think it's a Ferrari.
I think it's a Ferrari.
The story of Pininfarina begins not in an industrial complex, but in the humble town of Cortanze d'Asti, Italy. Battista Farina was born in 1893 as the 10th of 11 children. What do you think that'd be like?
Yeah, how about that, Joe?
Well, back then it was like, I need to have 10 children because they have to support me when I'm when I'm an old man of 53 years old.
Also, there's a big thing in Italy where grown ass men still live with their parents.
That's where it's like a worldwide thing.
Yeah.
But it's like bigger in Italy. I saw something on it where it's like the mom's like, you're never leaving.
I feel like it's also a thing in like Hispanic culture. It's also a thing in like Indian culture. It's just everything is expensive now. Yeah. So
I wouldn't mind that, I guess. Living back in Atascadero with my parents.
I fantasize about that sometimes where I'm like,
you fantasize about living with my parents in Atascadero? Yeah.
Imagine Janice and Scott just like feeding me three meals a day.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Early in his life, Battista earned himself the nickname Pinin, which means smallest or youngest in the local Piedmontese dialect.
But then he had a younger brother or sister, right?
Right.
So what happens then? How do you keep his
then
name?
Then they named him Pininini.
Pininini. This unassuming start was in opposition to the colossal impact he would eventually have on automotive design, transforming the very notion of how cars look and feel. At just 11 years old, Battista's immersion into the world of automobiles began in earnest when he started working at his elder brother Giovanni's coach building firm, Stabilimenti Farina. It was in this shop, amidst the intoxicating scent of leather and fresh paint, alongside the buzz of machined metal, where his passion for cars ignited and took shape. His brother recognized his innate talent from the get-go. At the young age of 18, he was handed his first significant design project, crafting the radiator for the all-new Fiat Zero, a gig that set him on the path of redefining automotive aesthetics. So he's going to make a radiator?
Yeah, but Have you seen this radiator?
I've not seen this radiator. In 1920, at the age of 27, Penin journeyed to Detroit, where he somehow managed to secure an audience with the Henry Ford. After a short chat, Ford found himself so impressed with Batista that he extended a job offer to the scrappy Italian. For anyone in his position, this would have been the highest of honors, but Penin returned to Italy without accepting the job.
What did he go there for?
the pizza.
While he left. Yeah. He's like, well, you're putting the sauce on the top of the stuff?
I gotta see this with my eyes.
While he was deeply inspired by the industrial scale he had witnessed in the American automotive landscape, he refused to be a cog in someone else's machine. He didn't just want to make a mark on the American automotive industry, but the entire global auto trade. Throughout the 20s, Batista refined his craft and championed the innovative designs within Stablemente Farina. He quickly moved beyond sketchbooks and drawing boards and found himself behind the wheel, famously winning the 1921 Aosta Gran San Bernardo race in a car of his own design. He even set a track record in the process that remained unbroken for 11 years. So this guy could, he could deal, he but could he, could al- he could also wheel. Yep.
He nice. Can wheel and deal.
These racing endeavors, driven by a profound passion for speed and engineering, proved serendipitous, bringing him into direct contact with other big shots of the up-and-coming Italian auto scene, including a fiery young man who would become a close friend and legendary collaborator, the one and only Enzo Ferrari.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Pietro Vespa.
Oh, that would have been good, too. Have we ever talked about Vespas on the show?
No, but I don't think that's a real guy. Vespa means wasp in Italian because of how it sounds.
The year 1930 marked a turning point in Batista's career. Penin made the bold decision to break away from the family business with an ambitious vision to establish a coach building company that would seamlessly blend artisanal craftsmanship with industrial efficiency. What an idea. On May 22nd, 1930, his dream took form when he filed papers to establish Carrozzeria Penin Farina. I like that he included his nickname.
Yeah.
In there. It's cool.
It's got Farina. A ring to it.
And it's also cool that it's like, it's one, it's he's made it one word.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Penin Farina, Penin which
Farina.
Is
little Farina. Yeah. This venture, as with any ambitious startup, was not without its hurdles. Batista faced many challenges securing the needed cash to launch an independent enterprise. Batista navigated these challenges with a shrewd strategic vision. He managed to secure financial
fraud.
He managed to secure financial backing from his wife's wealthy aunt and significantly from his esteemed friend and titan in the automotive world, one Vincenzo Lancia.
We talked about Lancia a couple
months
ago.
Yeah.
And great it was story. A very surprising company.
That was a fun one.
Really cool. Yeah.
Lancia's involvement was more than just monetary support, though. It was a powerful vote of confidence from within the industry, signaling to the wider automotive community that Batista was a serious and capable force. This deep collaboration with Lancia cultivated Pininfarina's willingness to embrace new manufacturing techniques, a trait that would prove vital for future growth. In its first year, Carrozzeria Pininfarina was a lean startup. He employed just 18 people and produced a modest 50 car bodies. The ambition was palpable, with a clear objective to rapidly scale up production to an impressive rate of 7 to 8 car bodies per day.
Damn, that's a lot.
Yeah. Penin wanted to compete with the big boys in numbers, but offer the quality of bespoke coach builders in every car that left the line. The company wasted no time in making its presence felt on the international stage. At the prestigious 1930 Paris Motor Show, Carrozzeria Pininfarina unveiled a stunning collection of models. Their artistry was on full display on chassis from some of Europe's most esteemed brands, including Lancia, Alfa Romeo, Isotta Francini, and Fiat. Penin also upgraded a Cadillac V16, proving he wasn't limited to just Italian manufacturers.
That's so sick.
That's really sick. How annoying would it have been? Not annoying, but like if today you still had to buy a chassis from one company and like sure. select a body from another one.
God, that would take forever.
Yeah.
Well, that's why GM bought the coach company. Mm-hmm. Shit. What was it?
I forget, but their emblem was in
body,
my...
Body by
Jake.
Fisher?
Fisher?
Why am I blanking on it?
I know what you mean. They had the little emblem. My parents, El Camino, had the little emblem on it. Yeah.
Inside the door.
Yep.
Did we ever talk about them?
I think it's Fisher, right? Look it up. Would you look it up?
Sure. Body by Fisher.
Nice.
Damn. Carter. Okay.
Good pull.
Nice. Pin and Farina quickly distinguished itself by embracing modernity and aerodynamics in its earliest days, a field Batista saw not as a mere technicality, but as the very, quote, form of speed. In the mid-1930s, a period when many in the industry viewed frameless or unibody construction as a threat to the traditional coach builder's craft, Pininfarina boldly pioneered its use. They collaborated closely with Lancia, a true innovator of unibody construction, becoming the first coach builder to adapt their designs to this advanced method.
It's so funny how history repeats itself and everyone is always just scared of the new thing. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. People are still scared of EVs now.
And the young people don't want to work.
Yeah. No one wants to work.
Yeah.
What is this me generation?
When they put the mirror finish on that Time magazine, I knew it was over.
Wait, are you working at Time at the printing press?
Well, yeah.
Oh, the mirror, like, oh, yeah. I'm the Time person of the year. That was the lamest thing. I remember I was probably like 10 at the time, but I was like, this is so dumb. And so the mirror didn't work very well either.
No, yeah.
Sloppy.
Yeah.
The person of the year is a amorphous pseudo-faced blob. I want to read about this guy.
And he smells. I can smell him.
But that's why they have the inserts where you open it up and it's got the fragrance on it.
Dakar Noir.
Yeah.
Sorry. This forward-thinking approach culminated in the Lancia Aprilia Aerodynamica, a groundbreaking race car boasting an astonishingly low drag coefficient of 0.40, which is the same as a PT Cruiser. But back then, it was very impressive. By 1939, Carrozzeria Pininfarina had experienced remarkable growth, expanding its workforce to 400 employees and achieving a production rate of 150 bodies per month.
Damn, that's a lot.
That's a lot of bodies.
I can barely do 2 bodies a week.
Yeah, that's really tough.
And I'm working a lot.
Strong collaborations with major manufacturers such
You've done 2 bodies in 16 months.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Nice, dude. Strong collaborations with major manufacturers such as Alfa Romeo, Fiat, Lancia, and Renault further cemented their pre-war standing as a premier design and coach building firm. But with the threat of war bubbling up in other parts of Europe, the Italian company was about to face its biggest obstacle. By 1939, the vibrant hum of car production at Carrozzeria Pininfarina came to a grinding halt. The company, with its 400 skilled employees, demonstrated remarkable adaptability, pivoting its production to support the war effort. Their workshops, once dedicated to crafting luxurious car bodies, now turned their attention to building essential vehicles for the Italian military, including ambulances and specialized searchlight carriages. This shift, while necessary, represented a stark departure from their core mission of creating automotive beauty. However, the war's devastation struck home for Pininfarina. The very heart of their operations, the factory in Turin, suffered a catastrophic blow when a direct hit from Allied bombers reduced the factory to rubble.
That happened to Fiat, too.
Yeah. It was also in Turin. I think they hit Turin pretty hard. They hit the Ferrari factory in Maranello, but I'm not sure about any other in the Bologna area.
From the ashes of war, Carrozzeria Pininfarina embarked on a truly remarkable journey of rebirth. Production.
Do you know how you pronounce Bologna, though, in English? No. Oscar Mayer.
Hey.
Did you see that they're Oscar Mayer, Italy. They're hiring drivers for the Wienermobile?
Yeah, they do it. It's a stint. Like, when you get hired, it's your job for like a year.
Like the highest casualty rate out of any driver. I'm just kidding. Jeez. It's because of the nitrates.
I was going to say.
It's the heart disease from driving. So the pay is good. We'll take care of all your hotels, gas. Yeah. You get to see the country, but you can only eat hot dogs.
Come out of the
dream job.
They come out of the dashboards.
Yeah, it's a little.
It's where there's not even any buns.
Usually is. It's just a dispenser.
It's like spring loaded too.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Wasn't ready for that. They're scalding hot. There's no bun.
They're cooked. They're, because they route the coolant around to cook it.
Yeah. It looks like it's going to be a cigarette lighter, but it's just a red hot hot dog that shoots out.
Well, apply today.
Production cautiously resumed with models like the Lancia Aprilia Bilux, signaling the first tentative steps towards recovery. The early 1950s witnessed a rapid and impressive resurgence as the factory workshop's international fame and success began to soar once more as they rebuilt their home shop. The definitive statement of this resurgence arrived in 1947 with the debut of the Sistalia 202 at the Mostra della Carrozzeria Italiana. Woo, that was a lot. This car.
You're nailing it, dude. I just want to take a second to appreciate
your
pronunciation today.
Thank you. I'm on it today. Sisitalia.
And by it, I mean Ritalin.
I think my friend was on Ritalin in the 90s. That's like meth, isn't it?
What?
Isn't it like the same active?
No, ingredient? Dude, it's like Adderall, but like
25%
less. Just
it's a stimulant. It stimulates the.
That's
that
is beautiful.
Speaking of stimulating my frontal lobe,
that's a good looking car, dude.
Yeah.
Wow.
Especially in red.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, this is a audio format, but.
Sorry. We're going to put.
Let's describe the car. It's very swoopy.
It's swoopy. It's got the long nose, short deck. It reminds me, it's like if there was an Italian kind of like E-type Jag.
Yes.
Yeah,
is what I would say. With like an ovalish kind of grill on the front.
It's got some like Porsche 356 vibes a little bit.
It's got some Mercedes vibes from the era as
with
well.
The headlights, very much, they're SL inspired.
But this is years before.
Dude, this is SL, sick. By the way, healthline.com, the difference between Adderall and methamphetamine. While Adderall and methamphetamine are two different drugs, some of their differences are more pronounced than others.
What?
So
that's the worst AI summation.
This is from a website. Doesn't have an author. So it probably is AI. Yeah. You're correct. Got to watch
out. I think Ritalin is less intense than Adderall by
really
like a factor of four.
I've never...
25%. That's what I was told.
Okay.
When I took Ritalin.
Gotcha. I haven't taken any of that.
I had a Ritalin prescription when I was in college, and it helped me. But
yeah.
It's like, well, I don't want to use, like, you get that, is this going to change who or whatever? And the analogy that was used to make me more comfortable is like, well, if you're nearsighted or whatever, you wear glasses.
Yeah.
You know, so
the doctor don't be was worried. Like,
yeah.
Have you ever seen the movie Limitless?
Yeah, it's like that. But we used to, if there was like a big paper and I was behind it, people would be like, hey, are you coming out or what are you? It's like, no, I got a paper. I got to ride the R train.
R train.
Yeah.
Nice.
So we called it.
Like, all right, dude.
Yep. But nobody else knew what it meant. And they just stopped talking to me.
I probably could have used some of that in college, that's for sure. Anyway, so the Sisitalia 202 was not merely a design. It was a revolutionary, quote, sculpture in motion. It was immediately recognized for its groundbreaking ponton style, a design philosophy that integrated fenders and bodywork into a seamless, flowing form.
I think in English it's pontoon.
Ponton. Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
This design philosophy fundamentally influenced the direction of post-war car design globally. The significance of the Sisitalia 202 was so profound that it achieved an unprecedented honor. It became the first automobile ever included in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Oh, so it should be in a museum.
If you've ever been to MoMA in New York, maybe it's still there. I don't know. This extraordinary recognition transcended the automotive world, cementing Pininfarina's place not just in vehicle history, but in the broader world of art and industrial design.
We gotta steal this car. We gotta
steal it, dude.
The heist movie.
Hell yeah, that's kind of cool.
Right? You drive it out of the...
They should do an Expendables, but with like car guys. So you get Vin Diesel, Nick Cage.
I see. So anybody who's been in like a big car movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was going to say James Taylor, but he passed away, didn't he?
Like the folk singer?
Yeah. He was in Tulane Blacktop. You ever seen that? Mm,
no.
Dude, Tulane Blacktop.
Yeah. Is it good?
Vanishing Point.
It's a bit of a slow burn, Joe, but it's very good.
Dude, any movie that I watched before like 98, I'm like, this is so slow. Yeah. What the hell's going on? The internet has just broken my brain.
Yeah. I'll lend it to you. Do you have a Blu-ray? Do you have a Blu-ray player? Do you have something that can play Blu-rays?
Do you have it on VHS? Because I could do that.
I'll just pop down to Circuit City and grab one.
Okay.
A buddy of mine said he got... They were worried about the kid, like, oh, he's going on and like getting his own YouTube video kind of stuff, where he's like, I want to do ABCs. And they'd put on ABCs, but he figured out how to use the remote to do something just brain rotting, you know? So what they did is they got, they ran it through a VCR to record like a playlist for him. And now he just goes into the room and turns on the TV and watches the,
that's pretty
VHS.
Cool.
Yeah. And I was like, that's a really good
YouTube on VHS.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of, isn't that funny? Isn't it right? It's
that's
like,
a good idea.
Huh. Yeah. On the old, the cathode ray tube. And
I've been bringing this up every so often. I bring it up to our merch people, but like, I would love to do like physical media of our video, like put a high low on a Blu-ray or something, but putting high low on a VHS is actually way cooler.
Yeah. My friend,
or Laserdisc.
That'd be sick. My friend Brian does like mischief style stuff. Like he's like really good at, so he released Dookie 30th anniversary on a bunch of different devices. So like one was like a Big Mouth Billy Bass that had one song on it. One of them was like they all come on different like nostalgic devices. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's sick.
Yeah, it was really cool. Well,
my roommate when I was in Chicago, like he went to CVS, whatever. And then there was a Big Mouth Billy the Bass out. And I was like, oh, I got Billy the Bass. And then, so I like took it out, mounted it above the door. Like I was psyched on this thing and like hit play. And then he like came out, he was going to go out or whatever. And he came back out and I was like, look, I mounted it. He didn't get it for the apartment. He got it as like a joke for his girlfriend.
Oh.
But he said, I was so happy that he couldn't tell me that the Billy the Bass wasn't for me. And so that was very nice of him.
Yeah.
And then he goes back to CVS to get the Billy the Bass to give as the joke, as he originally intended.
They were out.
And no, he said the lady looked at him and she just goes, that good, huh?
Yeah, that's awesome. I would love to modify a Big Mouth Billy Bass to be a Bluetooth speaker that like while you're listening to your music, it's like headbanging. That'd be sick. Okay. 1947 marked the beginning of Pininfarina's fruitful collaboration with Maserati. This led to the design of the first Maserati production car, the A6 1500 Coupe, which sported an innovative 2-liter, 120 horsepower straight six, which pushed the two-seater to the current performance limits. Pininfarina had achieved a global reputation for style and grace with their designs. In 1951, they designed their first American cars. There was the Nash Ambassador and the Nash Healey. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Me neither. In 1953, Batista was awarded the esteemed title of Cavaliere del Lavoro, or the Knight of Labor, by the President of Italy. The next year, two of the design house's models made their debuts. You had the Lancia Aurelia B24 and the Maserati A6 GCS Berlinetta. It's a mouthful, solidifying their place in the industry. The mid-1950s marked another pivotal turning point for Pininfarina, signaling a decisive and strategic shift from its cherished artisanal roots towards large-scale industrial production. This transformation was largely spearheaded by the creation of the Alfa Romeo Giulietta Spider, a car so captivating that Batista himself affectionately nicknamed it Fair Girl. The Giulietta Spider, designed by Pininfarina on a modified Sprint Coupe chassis, was introduced in 1955 at the insistent urging of one Max Hoffman, the influential U.S. importer. Hoffman, possessing a keen eye for market demand, had recognized the immense potential for small, elegant sports cars in America and pressed Alfa to deliver. The car was an immediate and resounding success, captivating buyers with its elegant lines and spirited performance. It proved to be the jump into industrialization that Pinin had needed. Their factory pumped out more than 27,000 units, Its basic appearance endured for nearly a decade before being succeeded by the equally iconic Duetto Spider. The success of the Julietta Spider validated Pininfarina's hybrid approach, providing the crucial financial stability and operational experience necessary for even larger scale projects. This period firmly established Pininfarina's strategic agility, demonstrating its capacity to evolve beyond a niche luxury coach builder to become a significant manufacturing partner for major automakers, a crucial expansion of capabilities for its long-term viability and growth.
They have to be the biggest coach builder at this point. 27,000 chassis per year, that's a lot.
Yeah. But, Joe, it would be their next collaboration that would plant Pininfarina firmly in the halls of automotive history.
Oh, I thought that was going to be a bad butt. You know, you hear butt and you're like, oh, is this a bad butt or a good butt?
It's a good butt. Good butt. They're doing so well, but they're going to
do even better.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
The automotive world, ever a hotbed of gossip and speculation, buzzed with skepticism at a potential deal with Pinin and Enzo. They'll never last, the naysayers announced. How could two prima donnas exist in one partnership? It's a great question. But as with many great partnerships,
we've got three here.
There was a brain. But as with many great partnerships, there was a brain and a bean counter. But with these two alphas, both were at the drawing board together. Everyone was convinced the deal would be over before the new year. Each company head was accustomed to absolute control in their respective domains. Enzo in racing and engineering, Battista in styling exclusive cars. Yet, Bart, in 1951, a legendary meeting took place that would defy all predictions and shape automotive history for decades to come. The two titans of industry agreed to meet on neutral ground, a restaurant in Tortana, a small town strategically located precisely halfway between Turin and Modena, that was famous for their hazelnut cookies.
Do you think it'd be a cool YouTube channel idea if I took like the menu from meetings of big moments and cooked that meal and then was like, oh, this is what Enzo ate. Yeah. And it was like, he started with an espresso and it would have been this brand.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he had a little crepe.
I think that's a cool idea.
It wouldn't have to just be automotive, but it could be like Stalin and Theodore Roosevelt met and they had a grapefruit.
Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan.
And Alexander the Great. Anytime a name from history is met.
And then you can start to do it like Deadliest Warrior style, where it can be like people who absolutely never met, but it's like imagining a meal between these two people.
Imagining
the Taliban ate this,
Jesus.
And the Greeks ate this.
Oh, it was like different parts of
They had
like whose meal would win.
Well, I don't know.
The meals fight.
And then you hire Navy SEALs to come in and eat the meal to demonstrate what it would look like if they ate the meal.
Imagine if Pol Pot had a meal with Jane Goodall. Yeah. What would they have eaten?
Yeah.
The short answer to your question, Joe, is yes. That's a good idea.
They all eat grapefruit.
Yep. Sorry. Just imagine. They had like the Taliban versus the IRA in one episode. And you're like, what is that? Like, what are we doing here? They had like Viet Cong versus, not ninjas. I forget. That show was crazy.
Anyone against Viet Cong in their native land, Viet Cong are going to win.
It was crazy. That show was crazy. Anyway.
I'd say the same about Taliban too. Because the Khyber Pass going up against, we sent the whole U.S. Army against them for 20 years and we couldn't do anything.
Yeah. Hilly terrain, tough to fight in.
Yeah. Can't kill an idea. Go ahead, Norm.
So, this choice of dining venue was a deliberate and diplomatic maneuver, orchestrated to avoid either man having to concede home turf and risk an ego-driven standoff.
You think Pininfarina's got a little bit of a, as we refer to it now, Napoleon complex?
Because his name's Pinin?
He's been short. He's been this little guy his whole life, and he tried to, took over his name. He took ownership of it. But it sounds like meeting with Enzo, who's also a notoriously... bullheaded individual.
But he wasn't short, but he was ugly. So he probably had some weird baggage surrounding him being so butt ugly.
Enzo Ferrari, he was ugly hot. you see a picture of him, you're like, man, not my cup of tea, but like,
I get
he's
it.
Quite dashing in some respects.
Yeah.
You look at this picture and you tell me that like people on TikTok wouldn't be like making fan cams of Enzo Ferrari if he wasn't alive today.
Yeah, he's got aura for sure in that picture.
Yeah.
But at this point he's like in his 70s or something, maybe 60s. No, he's
not. This is like in the 50s. So he's like he's probably
60s.
Like probably. 50, right? Okay, yeah. So he was born in like 53. He was like 53 at this. And this is a 1950s 53, so he's probably looking a little rougher than that picture that I showed you. Anyway, I digress.
They shouldn't have they got Adam Driver to play, and they should have gotten I'm blanking on his name. Is the dude from The Bear?
Oh, Jeremy Allen White.
They should have gotten Jeremy Allen White to play him.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. He'd be good.
He would have the fire too. I mean, Adam Driver's got that like,
and then the meals in that show too. You can So the atmosphere of this meeting, as legend has it, was one of mutual respect rather than confrontation. Over plates of pasta and a glass of Barolo, they found common ground in their shared passion for creating the world's finest automobiles. Bart,
I was going to say, it sounds like someone set up this meeting. Like, look, like the business end was like, we need this deal to go through. Mm-hmm. Let's set up this meeting because these guys are going to tear at each other's throats. And then they were just like, hey, what's up, man?
Yeah.
Pretty good food.
Like what you do. Yeah. This is great. Let's do this.
What are you sipping on?
Barolo.
Oh. It's like you have more experience with this, but when you're like, oh, my kid's going to really like act up, and then they, out of spite, they act really good.
Oh, right. Like, no. I've not had that happen, but I look forward to it. I'll try to bring it up like, oh, God, you know, really, it's really going to piss me off if you guys don't start screaming. I hope it works. I'll try it today. We're going to the aquarium after this.
So. Oh, that's fun. Nice. Long Beach one?
Yeah.
Nice.
By the end of that fateful conversation, a historic agreement was sealed. Pininfarina would henceforth, quote, be in charge of all design aspects of Ferrari.
I love it. It's great. And this is the like, hey, I'm going to hand it over to you. I'm going to control performance, that's precision. Crazy. You control design.
Yeah.
Must have been beautiful. One hell of a lunch.
Yep.
That's a good lunch.
Well, they let the Barolo do the talking.
Batista, ever the visionary, did not arrive alone. He brought his 25-year-old son, Sergio Pininfarina, or Sergio Farina. Did they change their name to Pininfarina?
I think so. I think they did. Think
what?
Yeah, because I fact-checked that.
Oh, wow.
And his name is Sergio Pininfarina.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. Sergio was a recent mechanical engineering graduate from the Polytechnic of Torino.
You can change your name.
You just change your last name?
Just do it.
You think there was any paperwork, or is this back at a time where he just told people that was his name and it stuck? Anyways, go on.
Anyway, this was a clear signal of Batista's intent to groom the next generation of leadership, and Sergio was immediately thrust into the fire. He was entrusted with managing the delicate and immensely fruitful relationship between these two companies. Dude, that's great. 25? Mm-hmm. Wild. Sergio possessed an energetic yet affable personality, a good sense of humor, and strong empathy. These were all qualities that would prove invaluable in navigating the strong wills of both Enzo and Batista. Sergio's ability to act as a buffer and translator and to reconcile these visions with practicality ensured the partnership remained drama-free. In the early days of the partnership, Pininfarina demonstrated its profound commitment and strategic foresight by building some prototypes at its own expense. Their bold proposition was simple yet irresistible. Quote, we'll design and prototype your next models essentially for free. If you like them, build them. And if you build them, We expect you to build them with us. This offer was a calculated risk that showcased Pininfarina's unwavering confidence in their own design capabilities and their long-term strategic vision.
Dude, spec work on this level of business is insane.
Yeah, that is crazy. Sergio didn't just want to win the contract.
But they are just—they are making a shit ton of cars still. Mm-hmm. So yes. It's like, we're going to make one of these. Mm-hmm. If you like it, you're ours.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Sergio didn't just want to win the contract. He wanted to build a deep foundation of trust and show a commitment to Enzo, a man known for being notoriously demanding, just like his dad. This bold move secured their exclusive design contract, ensuring that nearly every road-going Ferrari for the next 6 decades would bear Pininfarina's distinct styling touch.
I wonder if that was built into the contract or if they just kept like renewing contracts with them. Because like, imagine being in the 60s and be like, in 2015.
Yeah, I don't think it must have been renewed. Yeah, there's no way. They probably thought they're gonna have flying cars in 2015.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And we do. Here we are in 2015. They call flying it. To work in our cars.
The depth of this bond was further underscored when Enzo Ferrari himself eventually appointed Battista Pininfarina an honorary VP at Ferrari. This title underscored the deep and almost familial connection between the two companies. Sergio would later solidify this bond by joining Ferrari's board of directors in 1969. This partnership became the cornerstone of Pininfarina's global brand identity, elevating both companies to legendary status and demonstrating how a symbiotic relationship between a visionary engineer and an artistic designer could create automotive masterpieces that transcended mere transportation. The results of that fateful Tortona meeting were immediate. It ushered in an era of unparalleled automotive beauty at the Pininfarina HQ. In 1952, just a year after the handshake, the Ferrari 212 Inter Cabriolet debuted, draped in a Pininfarina body. This marked the very first prancing horse to wear their distinctive design, setting a precedent for decades to come. This was swiftly followed in 1954 by the iconic 250 GT, a car that defined the aesthetic of Ferrari Grand Tours. Under the leadership of Sergio, a stunning array of beautiful cars emerged from the design house. The 1959 Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase quickly became an archetype for the Ferrari Pininfarina technical aesthetic process, epitomizing a perfect blend of sporty performance and timeless elegance. The 1960 Ferrari 250 GTE became a surprise global hit, affectionately known as a, quote, family Ferrari, proved Pininfarina's ability to infuse practicality with undeniable style. The 1962 250 GTO, with its windswept lines, quickly ascended to the status of the most iconic Ferrari racer of all time.
That is a goated car.
It's goated. Its aerodynamic features, including an elongated hood, punctuated by 3 large radiator inlets and a distinctive turned-up spoiler, were honed through relentless race experience and design. Sergio Pininfarina played a pivotal role in shaping Ferrari's overall future, famously convincing Enzo to embrace the mid-engine layout for road cars. Whoa, this was a radical departure for Enzo, who, quote, did not want to know anything about 6-cylinder engine in his cars, let alone in the rear position. This vision first materialized in groundbreaking concepts like the Dino Berlinetto Special, which heavily influenced the production Dino 206 GT. The Dino initially met with resistance from purists for not being considered a, quote, real Ferrari due to its V6 engine.
That's so funny that there were purists all the
way back. Yeah.
Like 10 years after the car, the first car rolls off, there's purists that are like wringing their hands.
The Dino quickly changed opinions once clients had the chance to see it up close and drive it, becoming one of the most beloved Ferraris ever produced. 1968 Ferrari P6 concept, which we mentioned at the top of the show, unveiled at the Turin Motor Show, further previewed the styling cues that would define future mid-engine Ferraris. This was 68?
Isn't that insane? Because it looks like an 80s car.
Wow. Most notably, the Berlinetta Boxer. Pininfarina pushed Enzo into this mid-engine revolution, leading to the epic 4,390cc V12 BB with its distinct two-part body divided by the waistline, a design trick still used today by many manufacturers. Under Sergio's meticulous watch, Pininfarina styled nearly every road-going Ferrari from the mid-60s to the early 2000s, creating an unparalleled lineage of legends. This included the brutal yet beautiful 365 GTB4 Daytona, the fearsome 288 GTO, the poster-worthy Testarossa with its dramatic side strakes and aggressive stance. It became an undeniable icon of the 1980s. The Testarossa is one of the coolest cars ever, I think.
Yeah.
But after we did the video where we drove, I think, not the 308.
The Mondial.
Mondial. Thank you, Joe. We visited that shop where they were working a bunch of vintage Ferraris, including two Testarossas. The maintenance on those cars is crazy. They have to take
That guy, that mechanic was insane.
Yeah.
I would not want to be in a room with that guy.
He was...
He's very meticulous, and he loves what he does, but particular. Man.
But, dude, these cars demand
that level.
They demand that level. If you do something, like, the tolerances are so tight, and, like, the way they're designed, if you half-ass it, the car is going to – you're going to pay for it eventually. Right. Like, it has to be done that way. Otherwise, the car is not going to last.
And so, I feel like enough is there's no good enough.
There's no
there's
good
only
enough.
Wrong.
Yes. It's wrong. I feel like exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Even to the point where like non-structural bolts and screws or whatever still probably have a torque rating that you have to follow and use a specific, you know, whatever.
They're fragile cars.
Yeah.
Like the Testarossa, my point being was like, it's a sick car.
Yes.
But like, it's so demanding to keep
so precise.
Literally just running, not even just driving. Like, yeah, operational. There's also the Extreme F40 and the futuristic Ferrari Enzo, which bore their unmistakable touch. I didn't know they did the Enzo. That's cool. I love the Enzo. The Ferrari partnership, driven by both Battista's initial vision and Sergio's diplomatic and technical prowess, was more than a collaboration. It was a co-creation of automotive legends, setting benchmarks for performance and aesthetics that resonated globally with Ferrari fans. If you have a Ferrari Enzo out there, I would love to drive it. I gotta put that on my list, my bumper to bumper list. I have a list of cars for bumper to bumper that I want to drive. Nice.
If you guys have any suggestions for Nolan's bumper to bumper list, email passgas@donutmedia.com.
pretty high up on the list here.
We don't want to drive your Sentra.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
Beyond Enzo's hallowed halls, Pininfarina's influence extended to a multitude of other marks, showcasing their remarkable versatility. Yeah, the Lancia Florida, a visionary dream car concept, profoundly influenced subsequent Lancia production vehicles like the Flaminia, leaving an indelible mark on their design language. You also had the Fiat 130 Coupe with its distinctive square-rigged outline, stood as another accomplished design, demonstrating Pininfarina's ability to elevate even more conventional platforms. Their long-standing relationship with Peugeot yielded numerous successes, including the Peugeot 504 and its elegant coupe and cabriolet variants. You also had the Peugeot 406 Coupe in particular, which was widely hailed as one of Pininfarina's finest efforts. Turning back the clock a little bit to the 1950s, Pininfarina was trying to accommodate its industrial ambitions and the increasing demand for its design and manufacturing services. They erected a sprawling new state-of-the-art facility outside of Turin, which opened its doors in 1958. This move quickly ramped up production, achieving an impressive output exceeding 11,000 car bodies by 1960. A landmark achievement in technological leadership, one that would profoundly influence future designs, came in 1972 with the completion of Pininfarina's full-sized wind tunnel. This was not just any facility. It was Italy's first wind tunnel capable of testing full-scale cars, and one of only seven such advanced facilities in the entire world at the time. This investment moved Pininfarina beyond subjective art to objective science in design, particularly as aerodynamics became increasingly critical for performance and fuel efficiency.
It's always like a big achievement when car companies make a wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. But I'm always like, it's like a fan and a little bit of smoke, like a slow motion camera or something.
More complicated than that.
Yeah, I know. I know. I sound like an idiot. Like how it took him years to figure out how to make a little trail of smoke.
Fan and some smoke.
Okay, I thought you were going to say, which is something I was thinking of, is we were moving toward aerodynamic cars before aerodynamics was the primary concern. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying? And I think we would have gotten there anyway, which I think is interesting because they look better.
But I think even after these achievements, like the wedge era came.
Yeah.
And wedges are like horrible. Now we know that wedges are like pretty bad aerodynamically. Mm-hmm. It's so funny that they like didn't, you know, they're like, oh, let's make it look more like an airplane. But that kind of, the physics don't really translate on Earth.
Present day, the new millennium was difficult for Pininfarina. The car sector was contracting dramatically around the world. While Pininfarina continued to garner prestigious international awards, its sales struggled to keep pace with expectations for future growth. The company found itself operating at a loss for several consecutive years, accumulating substantial debt. By 2015, reports indicated that Pinin's company was a staggering $57 million in the red.
Yikes!
This escalating financial distress necessitated a, quote, strong bank intervention to avert collapse and ensure the company's continuity. In response to these pressures, some of Pininfarina's core but increasingly unprofitable activities were tossed. The most significant shift came in the manufacturing arm. By 2011, the company made the difficult decision to announce it would cease all automotive production. This painful but necessary step aimed to shed unprofitable segments and streamline operations for survival. They started designing and building some things that you see all over the world, like the Coke Freestyle machines.
Really? Oh.
Really?
Yes. What?
Yeah.
I mean, they do look cool.
Management clearly recognized that relying solely on the traditional automotive market was not viable. The human cost of this restructuring was significant, though, with employment figures plummeting from a peak of 2,768 people in 2006 to just 821 by 2012, reflecting the severe decline in manufacturing. Good Lord. This period represented a critical inflection point, forcing Pininfarina to fundamentally reevaluate its business model and seek a new strategic direction. The mounting financial pressures and the challenging automotive landscape brought serious change to their doors in 2015 when the Indian multinational Mahindra Group stepped in. They offered a much-needed lifeline to the struggling design house. On December 14th, 2015, Mahindra and its affiliate, Tech Mahindra, acquired a 76% stake in Pininfarina SPA for approximately $168 million. Wow. The initial acquisition cost for the controlling stake was reported to be around $28 million, a shockingly low valuation for a brand of Pininfarina's stature.
That's super low.
Excuse me. In addition to the cash payout, Mahindra provided guarantees for Pininfarina's creditors and pledged further investment in the company's future. Mahindra wanted Pininfarina's design shops on hand for their own design group, something they felt would be a huge differentiator in the current market. The company makes SUVs, utility vehicles, pickup trucks, light and heavy commercial vehicles, and tractors for the Indian market, a $25 billion market, and they employ more than 300,000 people.
Damn.
Yeah. For Pininfarina, the acquisition gave them cash in the bank and a big global partner to keep the invoices coming. Sadly, though, this deal pretty much wrapped up their exclusive partnership with Ferrari. While earlier models like the Ferrari California, 458, and FF still featured Pininfarina styling, their successors, the California T, the 488, and the GT4 Lusso, did not.
That kind of sucks that one of their last designs was the FF.
The FF's pretty cool, though. Like, we drove one on the channel, and we had a really great time.
I know, it's a great performing car. I just think it looks a little goofy.
It's a little goofy, but dude, you know, get the right wheels on it, maybe lower it a little bit. It's nice. It's nice.
Put like a big horsetail on the end.
Yeah, now we're talking. The launch of the LaFerrari in 2013, designed entirely by Ferrari's newly established Centro-style Ferrari, was a clear signal of Ferrari's strategic shift towards in-house design. The F12 Berlinetta was notably the last Pininfarina-designed supercar to bear the Pininfarina badge. The F12 is sick as hell.
F12 was really
cool. You know what? I might be thinking of the F12 as the one I really like. The FF's fine. The F12's dope as hell. Italians collectively poured one out for their fallen homies and looked towards the future. This forced Pininfarina to step out of Ferrari's shadow and carve out a new identity as an independent design house, even capable of producing its own branded vehicles. But the continued work on special, custom-commissioned, one-off projects for Ferraris demonstrates that the relationship, while fundamentally changed, is not entirely severed. Under the new ownership of the Mahindra Group, Pininfarina embarked on a bold and necessary path of reinvention, strategically focusing on its core strengths in high-end design and engineering services, like the Coke Freestyle machine. The company continued to...
You want to make the worst tasting Coke ever?
Yeah. Put it, give your Sprite some vanilla. Why not?
How about some Barks in there, too?
Yes. It's free one. Orange root beer? Sure.
Well, orange cream root beer? F*** it.
The company continued to engage in prestigious bespoke commissions and cultivate strategic partnerships across various sectors, from its traditional automotive roots to architecture, industrial design, and beyond. This diversification, initiated decades prior, now became central to its operational model. The most significant and symbolic manifestation of this new chapter arrived with the creation of Automobili Pininfarina GmbH. This new entity is headquartered in Munich, Germany, yet deeply rooted in the Italian design firm's heritage. It was established with a singular long-held purpose, to finally realize Pinin's enduring dream of creating a car exquisite enough to bear his own revered name. The culmination of this ambition was the Automobili Pininfarina Battista Hypercar, an all-electric performance vehicle that made its public debut to widespread acclaim at the 2019 Geneva Motor Show. I think James went
James
and looked
and
at
Jesse
it.
Went there. I wrote the bumper to bumper on it.
There you go.
It was as of yet unseen.
Yeah.
But because it was owned by Mahindra, all of the articles were in Indian.
Oh,
so wow. I had to like go to Indian websites and translate. And figure out the specs.
Wow.
But it's a beautiful car. Is.
It's super cool.
Yeah.
People have been spotting them out. I think they've like maybe only a little over 100 have made it out of the factory so far, but they're being spotted in the wild.
So this car is powered by a formidable 120 kilowatt battery pack supplied by Rimac Automobili, driving four individual motors that deliver a combined output of 1400 kilowatts, equivalent to 1900 horsepower, and a colossal stump pulling 2300 newton meters of torque.
And I'm sure a lot of stumps will be ripped out by this car.
The car features a lightweight carbon fiber monocoque chassis, which carries the whole thing to a top speed of 222 miles per hour. Very cool. Production of the Battista commenced in 2022 and was limited to an exclusive run of just 150 units, each meticulously hand-built by Pininfarina's master artisans at their dedicated atelier in Gambiano, Italy. The Battista represents Pininfarina's bold attempt to leap into the business-to-consumer territory with its own singular supercar, serving as a touchstone for luxury electric vehicles and an inspiration for all major manufacturers.
I love business-to-consumer business models.
That's pretty
good. One of my favorite business model.
It's top three for sure.
Yeah.
It's difficult to look back at all the hundreds of designs that came out of Carrozzeria Pininfarina over the last 100 years and find a dud. Their cars are timeless and elegant, and their success rate is second to none when it comes to universally loved designs. Most of that is due to Battista's unwavering confidence in his own taste and ability to hire like-minded people. Sadly, that heritage has fallen victim to volatile markets and acquisitions. But despite all this, we are reminded that at least one nugget of Pininfarina's soul lives on in the Battista, one of the most badass and stylish EVs ever built. Today, Pininfarina is building future-facing, city-changing mobility transports like maglev trains and buses, as well as buildings and fancy soda machines. Some of the most interesting clients Pininfarina are taking on today are Honda with their Restomod NSX project, with JAS Motorsports that will release a limited amount of the race-inspired cars to the public. They're also building a billion-dollar housing community in Dubai with Tassoli Luxury. They'll be so fancy, they'll make Porsche drivers feel like they're rolling around in Volkswagen Bugs. So pretty much back to their roots. And that's the story of Pininfarina. We did it. That was a long one. Thanks for sticking with us. A
lot of history there.
Also, the Ritalin thing, I'm pretty sure, is just something I heard when I was a kid in the 90s, and it's just stuck in my head. And I just thought it was true.
Like meth?
I just thought it was true because I heard it one time, and it just stuck with me.
Nick Swardson's got a bit where he's like, I heard that they say that heroin's harder to, or it's easier to quit doing heroin than it is to quit smoking cigarettes. So I tried heroin. They're wrong.
Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, Bart, for being here. Thank you, Joe. Good to have you back, dude. It's good to see your face.
I'm so happy to be back.
We'll be back next week. Stick with us. It's Past Gas. Bye.
Bye-bye.